Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy, recording at 1:02 p.m. the Pacific Standard Time, and today is December 7th. The Nasdaq was in positive territory today, but the S&P and the Dow Jones were in negative territory. There has been a little bit of a swing back to stay-at-home champions because of the rising number of cases and the sort of panicky environment that has engendered. California, in fact, announced today that they're going to release a tracing app. And the only thing that sprang to my mind, at least, was talk about closing the barn door after the horse has bolted. A tracing app back in April would have been much more useful, considering the fact that this week we're also going to see vaccines rolled out in the UK. What we can also anticipate is that there is going to be a massive oversupply of vaccines by the time we get into the third quarter, because we are looking at literally hundreds of millions being available now and billions being available by the end of 2021. That's just how a market works. When the government says that they're going to buy all vaccines, then companies are going to produce as many of them as is humanly possible. And that is quite likely to be the outcome that we have. But one thing that is also sure is we've had a pretty good run in markets over the course of the last 6 weeks. So we may be in for some consolidation. But the other thing is that when we start to think about what is likely in terms of the overall market environment, the dollar has been pulling back now for about 7 months. And it is oversold in the short term. It bounced initially in here today, and that was more to do with what happened with regard to the Brexit negotiations than any other factor. The pound had pulled back rather sharply right off the open because there was some verbiage to the effect that talks with the EU were on the verge of collapse, and then that did not appear to be the case, and Boris Johnson is now on his way to Brussels. So we're still in a brinksmanship-led environment. And the one thing that, and I think it is really the only conclusion that we can draw, is to look at the euro-pound exchange rate. It's right in the region of 110. It has bounced from 110 on repeated occasions over the last 4.5 years, and every single time it has got down towards these levels, there have been fears that the talks would collapse, and subsequently the talks have come good. So now we're really at the crunch, because if various European governments are going to have the time to pass whatever the Brexit deal eventually is, then it needs to be agreed relatively soon, which is finally why we have Boris Johnson negotiating in person. It was inevitable that it was going to come down to this, and now the big question is, what is going to be the upshot of it? I think the most likely scenario is that there will be a very limited agreement made, with a commitment to iron out a more broad spectrum trade agreement over the course of what could be years. And that will allow some face saving for the government. It will probably push one or two, at least, of the thorny issues off into the future. They may, in fact, never be agreed. There is that possibility. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's likely, but there's the possibility that what we're going to see is another fudge or a baby step towards an agreement. And then the question about whether the UK is in or out, and what the nature of the custom union will be, or custom separations will be, may or may not be, in fact, ironed out wholly before the end of the year. But one thing that we can think about is that politicians are already under a great deal of stress because of the coronavirus and the contraction in the economy. They're going to be under even more duress as a result of the Brexit negotiations. And the potential for a further contraction in the economy as a result of a negative outcome to those talks. So all governments at present have an incentive to try and minimize volatility. But one thing that I think is particularly relevant is when we think about European stock markets, whether that is the Euro stocks, which has paused over the last week but has rebounded pretty impressively since March, it's that from a US dollar investor's perspective, then, that has certainly not worked very well for Bloomberg, and I don't exactly know why that happened, but we know, for example, that if we redenominate the euro stocks into dollars, then we're coming back into the region of the all-time peak. Or, sorry, that's not exactly true, the peak from back in 2018. But then if we look at the S&P 500 and think about that in terms of a euro investor, so in US dollar terms, we are at new all-time highs, or really not far off. From a euro perspective, it's not at a new all-time high. So what we are starting to see here now is that US investors have a greater incentive to invest in Europe, and euro investors have less of an incentive to invest in the US. Now, this is a very significant change because we haven't had a condition like that in really quite a long time. When we look at the really remarkably impressive bull market that's been evident in euro terms for the US over the course of the last decade, then a European investor did very well by investing in the US because they had the benefit of currency market, capital market appreciation, as well as picking up the yield. Well, valuations now are rather rich and the dollar is coming down and the interest rate differential is gone. So there is an incentive to start looking elsewhere. So Europe is one of those markets which has been going sideways for a really awfully long time. And the FTSE 100 in the UK has also been going sideways for a very long time. Now, this is still denominated in euro. So it gives us a very clear example, I don't know why that's doing that either, of just how much of an impact the pound has had on the FTSE. When we go back and think all the way to 1999, in nominal terms, the index, if we just simply redenominated back into local currencies, we can then see that the stock market index is really not all that far away from the peak from back in 1999. But that's in local currency terms. So it really does help to really ram home the point that the UK has underperformed global markets by a very substantial margin because of the weakness of the currency in the aftermath of Brexit and the whole question then about the Brexit and then the pandemic. We've had an impressive rebound, but there hasn't been a compelling reason to jump back into the UK from an international perspective because of the weakness of the currency. So what happens next is going to be instructive because both Europe and particularly the UK have got attractive valuations on both a relative and nominal basis. Of course, one would need to come up with a more, I think, broad spectrum bullish argument for why the markets could start to take advantage of those valuations and really start to prosper again. Well, it's not beyond the bounds possibility at all that the UK may in fact come through with a strong growth trajectory and that the crisis of Brexit will have been enough to revitalize imaginations about how to generate growth and become globally competitive in something other than the financial services sector. So that is, I think, going to be one of the most important things to pay attention to as we look at what the potential is for the UK as it comes out of Brexit and out of the EU overall. What we can also start to think about is that gold prices have rebounded further, and this now is looking increasingly like a clear, at least short-term bounce from the region of the trend mean. This hasn't really looked like anything other than a consolidation in the region of the peak over the course of the last while. One thing that I think is particularly relevant is we've seen a really quite significant uptick in the kinds of things that people worry about. So there has been some talk about central bank selling, and we've seen that central banks were net sellers in the third quarter. But if you dig down into what exactly was going on, well, it was really only two central banks were selling. One was Turkey, and the other one was Uzbekistan. Well, Turkey has already committed that and has been buying all of the domestic supply of gold from Turkey. So therefore, there is, and that is a longer term policy. And they're using that domestic supply of gold as a way of supporting the currency on occasion. So the Turkish lira has steadied up over the course of the last couple of months, and the primary reason for that was because they sold gold and generated additional foreign income. So we may see some additional selling by Turkey in extremis when they are in a position where they absolutely have to do something to revitalize demand for the currency. They may go ahead and sell some gold, but in between those times, they'll just use the printed lira to buy up domestic supply. Uzbekistan is a slightly different scenario. They've got the largest open pit gold mine in the world. They've got about 700 tons of gold, and they sold some of it to deal with the pandemic. It's an isolated country. They've got, I think it's some ridiculously large quantity of their reserves in gold, something upwards of 50%. So they may be encouraged to sell gold, but they're also investing significantly in boosting gold supply. And it is likely to become one of the most significant gold producing countries in the world. Then we've also had this talk about ETF selling. I've seen a number of articles over the course of the last couple of weeks talking about the number of or the quantity of selling that's come out of gold ETFs. It's contracted by about 4%, coming from approximately 112 million ounces down to 106 and change. So, yes, there has certainly been some ETF liquidations, and it is the largest liquidation in at least the last couple of years. But is it really anything other than a reversion back towards the mean? Probably not. And then there is the additional bearish argument that gold is losing out to Bitcoin. Well, there is no argument there. Bitcoin has been outperforming gold of late, and it was in positive territory over most of this month or most of the last month while gold has been pulling back. But one thing that I think is particularly relevant is that while everybody likes to make comparisons about gold and Bitcoin, and obviously there are comparisons on the limited supply front and the store of value front, but then you also have the fact, and I think it is much less well considered, that Bitcoin tends to trade like a commodity, and most particularly, it tends to trade like gold. Both are inherently volatile. They're best bought following reactions, and when they do fantastically well, they become much more dangerous to invest in because of the risk of contractions and additional reversions back towards the mean, and they both tend to overshoot on both the upside and the downside, and they both have these very explosive breakouts when they do go. Well, gold has been consolidating since August, and Bitcoin has been rising since the beginning of September. If gold is starting to turn around again, in fact, what is perhaps more likely is that Bitcoin may start to underperform and that gold will start attracting money back out of Bitcoin. We may not be seeing a secular change in terms of demand, but really a short-term change. That's again not something I've seen many people consider. But Bitcoin has at least stopped going up, and it is really quite overextended in the short term. So there are some risks in just assuming that Bitcoin can only move in one direction. When I think we start to think about all of the bearish factors that have been brought to bear in the argument against gold, it's worth, I think, remembering that most of them are short-term in nature. And the reality is that I really do think that the coronavirus has had the same psychological effect on public policy as 9/11. They've both represented massive shocks to the system that led people to question the foundation of the whole social contract. And they also both are representing this massive response from public policy in terms of keeping interest rates down and massively increasing spending, and in the process, devaluing fiat currencies. It ushered in the first period of financial repression. Well, we're now almost 20 years on, and the second bout of financial repression in this century is just another bigger example of what happened in 9/11, or in 2001, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So now we're thinking, or I guess we have to start thinking about the potential that nominal price appreciation may persist in Wall Street, but that hard assets are likely to continue to perform, and it is looking increasingly likely that gold is in the process of bottoming, that gold shares are steadying from the region of the trend mean. So this is also I think, an ideal area to anticipate support starting to come through. Then when we start to think about what else is likely to do well? Well, emerging markets generally tend to do well in a weak dollar environment. The Asia Dollar Index was unchanged in here today, but it has clearly broken its downtrend overall. When we think about the Chinese market, then what they are doing is, so far, to allow their currency to appreciate. They have not been as aggressive on the monetary side as the USA has, and the CSI 300 has clearly broken higher in US dollar terms, but in local currency terms, it is coming back into the region of the peaks over the last 12 years. When we then think about the financial sector, as an arm of the government, it does tend to reflect government policy, and it is easing from the upper side of its range. Well, banks, as arms of the government, could be anticipated to do rather well if the government were very aggressive in terms of how much they were spending and pushing into the economy. So they have been holding back. That's why banks are not doing so well. But then the other point is that 10-year Chinese government bonds yield about 3.3% in a strong currency, and that is the kind of, I guess, a sales argument that would encourage people to invest. What it is also starting to do is to create additional demand for other emerging markets. Obviously, there are challenges with investing in China, and not least on a governance front. India is attempting at least to push through necessary reforms. They really have to get this done, regardless of whether there are people protesting on the streets about the removal of farm subsidies. It is imperative that India push through the kinds of economic reforms necessary to stoke economic growth over the next decade. About half the population is going to enter the workforce over the course of the next 15 years. It's an incredible demographic dividend. It is the kind of demographic dividend that could lift hundreds of millions of people out of poverty and into the middle classes if growth-oriented good governance is adopted. And it is looking increasingly likely that that is what India is doing. Of course, it is also an extraordinarily volatile market, and it is a little overbought in the short term. But it is also likely that India is going to rebound on a growth front and completely obviate the decline that we saw in 2020 next year. I continue to think that there is a massive amount of pent-up demand in the global economy. And when vaccines are rolled out and we come through at the tail end of this pandemic, then what we are likely to see is a party attitude similar to the end of the Second World War, where people will be out on the streets celebrating. Now, whether that is in restaurants, at concerts, or at sports events, and whether it is just a joie de vivre way of thinking about the market and about their lives and how best to make the best of it, then we're likely to see a great deal of consumption next year. It does suggest that we may have some inflationary outcomes, and realistically, that is exactly what governments want. 10-year Treasury yields, though, have so far steadied around the 1% level. Governments do want an inflationary outcome, and when we think about the inflation, I really have to, I can't seem to type and chew gum. When we think about the inflation rates that the market are putting in, it's up to about 2.28%. 10-year yields are still around 1%, so we have this massive negative real interest rate environment. That's exactly what governments want. They don't want to see government bond yields rising. Central banks are going to aid them in trying to keep those longer-dated yields under control, and that is going to, I guess, recapitalize governments over the significant medium term. They are courting inflation. Eventually, they will get inflation. And we're likely to see a boom ahead of inflation becoming a problem, a bust afterwards. But we do get the boom before the bust. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.